Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
It is the best career in the world, in my opinion, and I know that there are lots of people who consider it, but only mine is true. I pinch myself every day that I get to go into work. I consider myself so lucky to be working in the industry that I fell in love with as a teenager and, you know, as a young woman. There is no one size fits all when it comes to air traffic. There is nothing really that excludes you from it. Don't let society tell you that you can't or that you shouldn't or that it's too hard, because the hard work is really worth it.
Hello and welcome to Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson and welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today's guest is Kim, an Approach Air Traffic Control Officer. She's got a popular and sometimes outspoken social media profile and is a trustee of the new charitable organisations called AIR, Aviation in Reach. Kim, welcome to Extended.
Thank you for having me.
It's a delight to have you. I've followed you on social media. It's always an entertaining journey. So that makes for an interesting discussion. But what I really want to start with is your background. How did you get into aviation? And more important, how did you become an air traffic control officer?
I fell into air traffic, really, or fell into finding it. When I was younger, I wanted to be a doctor. Everything was geared up towards medicine. And I briefly toyed with the idea of going into the RAF. So I applied for a bursary. And whenever you apply for anything for the RAF, you always have to do the same aptitude tests, one of which being for air traffic. I failed the interview spectacularly. But the aptitude test side of it, I'd done really well. And in my debrief, they essentially said, you know, you haven't made it into the RAF, but we really recommend that you look into air traffic control. I'd never heard of it. I had no idea what it was. They gave me some brochures and I went away and thought, actually, this looks like a pretty interesting career. I applied when I was 18, not knowing anything about air traffic, not knowing anything about the application process, was completely blown away with the kind of things that you have to be able to do for air traffic, and then spent the next 9 years on and off applying both to the RAF and to civilian organisations. Every time I saw Top Gun, then I applied to the RAF very much. So after finishing my degree, that's when I fell into aviation, really. I got a job at my local airport as a security officer just to get some money going, just to figure out what I wanted to do, because by that point I didn't want to do medicine anymore. And that's when I fell in love with aircraft and airside and airports. And that's when I really kicked into gear of thinking, actually, air traffic is definitely what I see myself doing.
And what you mentioned finishing your degree there, what was your degree in? Was it relevant or not? Does it matter?
It's completely irrelevant to air traffic. I have a BSc in pharmacology. So the study of drugs and I guess you'd normally go into, say, Pfizer or something to research new drugs. It was still very beneficial for me. It set me up with motivation for studying and a very kind of rigid way of studying. So I'm very good, which is really helpful for training for air traffic, because there's a lot of stuff that you have to learn. It's not just the practical side of it, it's the background. And it's given me a certain way of thinking. It's made me analytical. It's made me, when I know my stuff, I know my stuff. Yeah. And that's given me a confidence. So although it's not really relevant to air traffic, I'm still incredibly proud of the fact that I do have a science degree. Because again, it just means that there's another female, you know, woman with a STEM background.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, that's quite interesting. Thanks for sharing that. So I just want to come back again. You sort of stumbled into air traffic control. Do you think there's a bit of a problem then in particularly younger people and people starting out on their careers trying to find that career path?
Yes, I would say that there is. I don't think air traffic is very widely even considered. People think about aviation and they think about pilot or the airports, you know, aircraft engineering. They don't really think about the voices on the other side of the headset. And I feel a bit of an obligation, especially with my kind of Twitter presence, of presenting that to the world. You can't be what you can't see. So I think if I can try and get the word out however that I can to say, look at this amazing career that I'm doing, and to try and let people know just that it's there. I can't do too much. I'm only one person, but I think every little helps in terms of promoting the career that I adore.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's interesting. So you're an air traffic controller now. Not sure. How long have you been doing it for, Kim? How long have you been?
I joined my company in 2012.
Right.
It's called Validating, so becoming qualified to control on my own in 2017, November 2017, on my first sector, which was Luton, and then my second sector, which is Stansted, I actually validated for that last year.
Right, okay. Now, if my maths are right, that's 5 years of training.
Yes, it's intense. It's really intense.
Talk us through that. That's quite a big commitment to make, isn't it, before you're unleashed? Not that that's not the right way to do it, but again, coming into that career, people would need to understand there's a heavy commitment on training and validation, as you say, because it's such a critical role. Tell us what happened in those 5 years.
So not all of it was solid training. And that's another, I don't know if it's just specific with my company, but you don't necessarily go all the way through. There will be gaps in your training purely because of the way that the training system is run in terms of when the courses are. I had to do 4 courses purely at the college stage. So before I'd even spoken to an aircraft live, I did basic, which everyone has to do. I then did another 2 courses to get an area rating, which was my first rating, and then another course to get my approach rating, which is the rating that I use day to day as an approach controller. There were several breaks of at least a month, sometimes up to 3 months. So I didn't leave the college for a while. And then when I got to terminal control to start my training, once I was consistently training, I'd say it was a good 18 months of solid training before even being put forward to do the assessment to then be told that I could control on my own. Because it's not just the practical stuff. It's not just turn left, turn right, everything behind it. So you have to learn about aviation law. You have to learn about the rules and regulations you'll be following. You have to learn about weather and the impact that that can have. Aircraft performance. There's a bit of maths in there as well. There's altimetry. While I was training Monday to Friday, after every day I was going home and doing at least 3 hours of additional revision and study.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's an amazing commitment. And Kim, just to understand for those who don't understand the structure, and we're talking about UK airspace then.
Yep.
You mentioned terminal control. We've talked about approach. Can you just give us a brief overview of what the different sectors are and what they mean?
Do you mean sectors in terms of portions of airspace?
Yeah.
Or, okay. How so you're an approach.
So you're an approach controller.
Yeah.
I'm sitting on a 737 somewhere coming from Amsterdam. What does that aircraft go through to hit your approach control, and what happens after approach control?
So coming from Amsterdam, the first people that you talk to in UK airspace would be an area controller. And that can either be higher level, although normally it would be another part of terminal control. So within our building, we have two separate rooms, I guess. You have area control, en route control, which is the super high level stuff. So that'd be stuff overflying the UK, stuff that's not London. So everything kind of north of London and that would overfly to go to talk to Europe and America. And then specifically the chunk of airspace over London is terminal control. And within terminal control, you have more area controllers and they will then link to approach controllers and vice versa. So if you're coming in from Europe, you would speak to an area controller. They would start adjusting the speed. They start adjusting your height. They'd basically put the aircraft in a beautiful position to then be passed over to an approach controller like myself, who would then do the final work of getting them in even nicer line and getting them even lower, putting them all on final approach before handing them over to aerodrome control. So that's, I think, what people normally think of is a tower controller.
Yeah.
So whenever I say I'm Stansted Luton, they assume that I'm switching between two towers.
Yeah.
When it's not. So you'll talk to tower anything from 6 miles out to about 12 miles away from the airport. That's when we'll hand the aircraft off to tower.
Right. Okay. And I suppose on a normal day, what would a normal day look like for you as an approach controller? And let's set the scene here. It's lots of shifts.
There are lots of shifts. So we start our shift cycle with two mornings, which start at 7 o'clock. So I'll come in for my shift. I will, we call it pre-briefing or first briefing. So I'll find out anything that's relevant to the day, if there's any predicted bad weather, if there's any air displays that I might have to avoid or overfly, if there are balloon flights due to come in or out of my airspace, just so I've got a really good picture before going in. I'll go in, grab my headset, and then I do a handover with my outgoing controller. So they'll talk me through everything. They'll tell me what the pressure, whether it's high or low pressure, for example, what runways we're using, if there's any weather, if there's anything non-standard, so that we get a really good picture between us and to make sure that that's passed over to me well. On a morning shift, the busy section for me is first thing in the morning. We call it the morning rush.
Yeah.
So you'll get everything that's taken off from Europe for that first kind of glut will come in. And then you'll get quiet sessions and you'll get busy sessions. We tend to do anything from half an hour to an hour on radar before going on a break. And that is regulated.
Right, okay.
We're very heavily regulated in terms of managing fatigue.
Yeah.
So the maximum that we can do is an hour and a half or 2 hours, depending on the time of day. And that is determined based on how busy the traffic normally is. So if it's a part of the day that is always really busy, we will only be able to do an hour and a half. Basically, you don't want a tired controller. You don't want a fatigued or, you know, stressed controller on the other end of the RT.
Yeah.
So we'll do our section, we'll go off, we'll go have a break, and then we'll come back and do it all over again, really. And then night shifts are a little bit different.
How long is a shift, Kim?
It depends. So a morning shift is 7 hours. An afternoon shift is about 8 hours, and a night shift is the longest, it's 9 hours.
Right, okay. And on a night shift, is knowing those airfields and the sort of activity, is it completely quiet? Are you on standby a lot of the time? Is there a lot of movement?
So it's more freight overnight. Stansted and Luton both are quite freight heavy. And again, you'll get your little flurries. So 3 o'clock in the morning, you'll get a little kind of mini rush. It's not a mini rush, but that would be the busy in quotes period of the night.
Yeah.
But there was always someone manning the radar. Just because there's no aircraft doesn't mean that we leave, because you can still have police helicopters. You can still have air ambulance. We might get the Coast Guard traveling through. So it's a different way of operating. And more often than not, because I hold a Stansted and Luton validation, I'll be working both sectors at the same time. So the radar's slightly bigger.
And where are you based then, Kim?
We're based in the south coast of England, kind of between Portsmouth and Southampton.
Okay, so you are at the Nats office there.
Yes, right, the big one. Okay. Yeah, the big Nats building.
I was working out my geography then, and for a second I thought, I'm not sure Kim is anywhere close to this. And that's quite common these days, isn't it? That you don't really need to co-locate in or around the area you're working.
No, the only person that needs to be, and I say that, tower controllers, we do obviously have the London City remote tower. Yeah. But for an approach controller, we get the radar feeds from across the country. So we have Stansted, Luton, Gatwick, Heathrow, London City, all of those feed into us. Yeah. So there's no need for me to be at Stansted or Luton, which means that one controller is doing two positions.
All right. Okay. All right. Understood. And how do you then stay current? Because I'm assuming that the validation to do something like Luton or Stansted approach needs to be revalidated. How often does that happen? And what's the sort of process you have to go through?
So every year we have a renewal, I think it's called now. So we are checked out by someone who's an assessor, so suitably qualified, has done the courses to be able to assess me as a controller and deem that I am competent and current enough to continue doing my job. So that's at least once a year. We also once a year have additional training. So we'll train for unusual circumstances, and we get courses throughout the year to remind us of our licensing obligations, to remind us of the hours that we can work, which are heavily regulated. We have to demonstrate that we understand those.
Right. Okay.
And then I still have to pass out as competent using paper strips, even though we use electronic. So that's a regular training thing that will come up and remind me that I need to do a particular course to keep me current on paper strips. So there's a lot.
Yeah.
Once you're valid, it's not the end of your training. We are constantly continuing to improve, constantly being assessed and monitored by our peers and also by our assessors.
So let's talk about some of the challenges in the role. I saw you respond to something on social media a week or two ago about go-arounds.
Yes.
And the publicity associated with that. I have to be a bit careful because sometimes I get a little bit carried away with seeing things. But in reality, there's an awful lot of misunderstanding around things like go-arounds and the whole air traffic control process in the public domain.
Yes.
That incident highlighted it, really, where the publication tried to create an eye-grabbing, attention-seeking post, but in reality, your response was, no, this is part of the process.
Yes. And it's a balance that I try to strike in terms of I love watching a good go-around video. I love watching weather videos and crosswind landings. I think they're really interesting and they're really exciting. And I have to remember that for me, they're exciting purely because they look good, because I know what's going on the other side. So I try to educate as well as also express frustration, because our industry's been through a lot. The aviation industry has been through a lot. And the last thing that I want to see is people who might have considered going on a flight, seeing a go-around video labelled in a dramatic fashion and going, oh, I don't think I could do it. I don't think I could do it. And it's also trying to explain to people and to take the mysticism out of it. And it's an understandable mysticism, because that pilot won't turn around and go, no, this is why we did it. You know, this is actually what happened.
Yeah.
So we're kind of at the mercy of what people share. But a go-around is a very standard procedure. It happens, sometimes it will happen two or three times a shift. Sometimes we'll go for maybe a whole week and not see one. But they can happen for the most mundane of reasons. They're very, very unusual to have them be an emergency situation. That's not to say that they can't be.
Yeah.
That's not to say that they can't lead to something. I don't want to oversimplify them either, but it's something that the crews brief for as part of every approach. It's something that we as controllers know how to handle. It's something that tower controllers know how to handle, And normally when a go around happens, we get the phone call from tower. This aircraft has gone around. Roger. And then we just fit them back in the sequence. It's almost a complete non-event 80 to 90% of the time. So I'd much rather that people said, look at this cool video. Yes, look at this cool video. That go around is impressive. It's amazing. Look at the skill of these pilots. You know, look at that crosswind landing. The skill of pilots is unparalleled for me. I have such admiration for pilots and the work that they do. But let's not drum up drama and fear just for the sake of more people seeing your video. It's really frustrating to me.
Yeah, okay, understood. So I don't want to dramatize conflicts and other things too much, but how does one train to handle those sorts of activities? What are the sorts of things you need to be prepared for as a controller that could happen that you need to mitigate?
So throughout training, right from the beginning, really, we are taught how to handle emergencies. Every year we undergo training on how to handle emergencies and unusual circumstances. We have kind of acronyms and lists. I couldn't tell you how many for every situation, there is some sort of list that we have on how to handle them. And we just practice. So we might do a tabletop exercise and discuss it amongst our peers. We might practice it on the simulator, where you'll have someone just create a situation, get it fed into the simulator and throw it at us, really. And then we'll discuss it afterwards. Right. The thing with air traffic is we are constantly learning and we are constantly sharing our experiences and we're constantly looking out for each other. We don't work in a bubble. So more often than not, if you have an unusual circumstance on your radar, you will not be alone.
Right. Okay.
We have almost a sixth sense for our colleagues, and we are always looking out for our colleagues, whether we're on radar, whether we're just walking past to go on a break, you can tell.
And Kim, one of the things that I always think about when I think about air traffic control is you're also not only are you visually representing aircraft on a screen, but you're also I suppose psychologically trying to picture the 3D image of the height, you know, the direction, the speed. How does one go about processing that? Has it become second nature? Is it something they help you to learn? Or
I think a lot of people talk about 3D picturing, and I have no doubt that a lot of people view it that way. I don't really have that 3D image in my head. I'm a lot more analytical, I guess.
Yeah.
In terms of, I will look at two aircraft. One might be at 5,000 feet and one might be at 4,000 feet. And my brain will literally go, that one is higher than that one. And that's the extent of my 3D imaging.
Right. Okay. Yeah, it's a different type of thinking. For example, I'm very visual, so I will think in a visual way.
Yes.
I'm not saying I can't be a controller. I probably can't, because when you talk about the maths bit, that rules me out completely. But is there a particular type of individual that lends itself better to the sector?
No. We have so many different people from so many walks of life. No two controllers are the same or have had the same experience or think about air traffic in the same way. It's something that as an instructor, you have to be mindful of as well in terms of how people learn. For example, I'm quite a global learner, they called it when I was training. I have to know everything before I can then get it. I can't operate only knowing part of the information, whereas other people can easily take part of the information and just go, yeah, I'm sure I'll learn as I keep going, and that works for them. But we've had people who left school, college at 18, came straight into air traffic. You have people with degrees like myself. You have people who just were told by the job centre to come and try it, and they did, and it turns out they're really good at it. Nobody actually knows what it is that makes an air traffic controller be able to control air traffic. They've never figured it out. So which is one of the things I always try to get across to people, is that if it interests you, try it. Don't ever rule out air traffic for yourself before you've tried it, because there is it's just a mental state that you're in. You can either do it or you can't, and that's the hard thing. It's not something that you can make yourself be able to do, because you do have to make reactions quickly. You do have to be able to keep a cool head under pressure. You do have to be able to adapt and come up with a plan A, B, C, D, E, ad infinitum, pretty much.
Yeah.
But you can't just say, oh, I came out of school with, you know, only six GCSEs. I can't be an air traffic controller. Yeah, you could.
Yeah.
You absolutely could.
G'day. I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
Did you know that the first G-suit for British pilots was essentially a chest-high pair of fisherman's waders which were filled with 2 gallons of water? The water automatically squeezed the pilot's legs as positive G was applied. Did you also know that the Islamic Republic of Iran Air Force's oldest McDonnell Douglas F-4D Phantom is set to clock up more than 70 years in service, having been delivered in 1968 and now subject to life extension programs taking it to 2040? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
Would you say for you, Kim, is the biggest challenge you've had to overcome to be an air traffic controller?
It's a good question. I have to remember that I have a lot of privilege behind me. So the main barrier, I guess, was not knowing about it. I didn't have any prejudices against me. Air traffic controller was very much not like that. To get in, once you're in and you're training, everybody is treated the same. I guess it was, for me, the challenge was the constant pressure, the constant assessment. After training for 5 years, where every day you are critiqued, that can be quite hard.
Yeah.
So you have to make sure that you have developed a resilience, and you have to make sure that you have a support network, not necessarily just outside of work. You have to be able to talk to others and not keep it inside, is what I found.
Right.
Because being told every day that you're not up to standard is hard. And even though you can't be at that standard yet because you're still training, that was the hardest thing for me, if every day going in, knowing that I was going to be watched and marked and monitored. Even though it's necessary, and you know, you can't not do that. Our job is far too important to not have the, you know, really strict standards that we have. There is not one controller who has got through because hopefully they're good enough. Every controller has passed that same rigid training scheme, that assessment scheme. They've all been checked out to the same standard. You know, every single controller is worth their salt.
Okay,
for sure.
Yeah. So one final question, just on sort of a similar topic, is how do you feel about the responsibility that you have? You would have at any one time multiple aircraft in the sky. Is that something that ever plays on your mind?
Yes and no. I know that my job is a very responsible one, and I take incredible pride in my job. And every day I go in with the aim to do it to the best of my ability, and should anything happen, to handle that to the best of my ability. But I almost separate the human element of it. I talk to the pilots and that's it. I don't think about the number of people that they have down the back, because I think that you'd start overwhelming yourself if you started thinking about just how many people you're responsible for it at any given time. But that's not to say that we just completely disregard them. It's just that you don't dwell on it.
Okay, that's interesting. An interesting way of looking at it. You mentioned flying earlier. Did I not see a picture of you in the front seat of a light aircraft? Is there an ambition for Kim to be pilot in command?
Absolutely not. I was that was my friend Katie.
Yeah.
And internally I was screaming the entire time. There is definitely a reason I'm sat in a comfy chair in a room with no windows, talking to and admiring the people on the other end of the RT. The whole time I just sat there thinking, what if something goes wrong? Even though, you know, my friend is a fully accomplished pilot and I trust her implicitly, that's not something I ever have any aspirations to do. But I do want to help other people get into that, especially from underrepresented communities and especially from those who maybe think that it's not for them or that they aren't worthy of it. That's something I'm very, very passionate about. So just because I don't like it, it's not indicative of anybody else.
So that's a nice segue to maybe introducing Aviation in Reach, the new organisation that you're a trustee of.
Yes.
Really excited about some of the stuff that's starting to appear. Sounds like it's got fantastic aims and objectives. Tell us what you're setting out to achieve here.
So what Aviation in Reach was set up to achieve is to try and remove some of the barriers for marginalized and underrepresented communities within aviation. So that's women, people of color, anyone who doesn't get represented in the way that should happen within aviation. For example, 5% of pilots in the UK are female.
Yeah.
Air traffic control wise, I don't have an exact figure, but it's not 50% representation. And it's looking at what we can do to help those people get a career in aviation, be it pilot, air traffic controller, or aircraft engineering. So, for example, I mentioned earlier that you can't be what you can't see. So we want to mentor people who have aviation career aspirations to try and remove those barriers, such as access to information, access to role models, access to people within the industry. Some people wouldn't even know who to ask or where to start if they wanted to go and visit a control tower or talk to a pilot. So we're looking to set up a mentor scheme of people within the industry, so who have significant experience within their specialism, to mentor younger people and hopefully facilitate them achieving their dream career in aviation.
Okay, well, that's a massive objective, Kim. That's quite overwhelming. How will you will the team go about that? What are the practical steps that you can start to put in place to start driving that interest?
So our trustee team are a group of amazing individuals. So we already have quite a breadth of experience and knowledge and networking already. And the aim is to set young people up with a specific mentor in the aviation arena that they want to be in, for example, pilot, air traffic controller. And through that, find out what their aims are, what would help them, what their career goals are, what they're looking to get out of mentorship, and guide them through the processes. So, for example, for an air traffic controller, it might be helping them to set up a visit to a tower. It might be talking to air traffic controllers. It might be finding out more about the training, more about the interview process, because some of the interview processes can be quite daunting. But also, success might not just mean they end up getting their career. Success might also mean that somebody who didn't have a clue what it was like to be a pilot or an air traffic controller or an engineer finds out actually it's not the career they thought of, and therefore they can focus their efforts elsewhere.
Yeah.
So it's quite a broad scope of what success actually is. So we're not promising the earth. We're not promising if you get mentored by us, you will get your career.
Yeah.
It's these are the barriers that we have identified and this is how we can help remove them or help you overcome them. Even if it's things like, for example, when I was a kid, I didn't know about air cadets. I went to Brownies, and that's
you haven't told Katie that, have you?
I did, yeah. I didn't know about air cadets until I was in my 20s and I became a civilian instructor for one. So you look back and you think, that's not to say that I would have become an air traffic controller any earlier. My circumstances are obviously completely different to other people's, but it's things like a young woman might not realise that air cadets are a thing that she can do. So if you introduce them, that might open a whole new world of employment and career opportunities.
Okay.
I kind of think until we have done everything that we can to promote these careers, we can't say that we're doing enough. And I think there's always something more that we can do to promote and encourage these careers for young people and for people who traditionally wouldn't think that they can do it or maybe have been told that it's not for them.
Yeah. And they're a difficult group to find, I would have thought. We probably all have examples of bumping into people, but how do you get that message out that Nation in Reach is there for them? You know, how would, you know, a young girl who lives in my village in Dorset know that you existed? How are you going to get that message out there?
That would very much be a very good question for Katie. They spearhead for Katie Lee. Katie Lee is our chair and our guiding light, I guess. She's definitely an inspiration to me, for sure. And the ideas that she has and the fact that she started this people and garnered a group of complete strangers up until now.
Yeah.
To even do this, to even attempt it, is amazing. For me, I think we have to just keep plugging away, doing what we're doing. So promoting it on Twitter and social media.
Yeah.
And then I think the idea is maybe as it progresses, we might start doing more outreach. So take up stalls, for example, at aviation events, maybe go into schools. But that's obviously quite a long-term goal at the moment.
Sure, sure. And what's the industry's response so far, Kim? Are you getting support from the industry?
We've been getting a lot of positive feedback, a lot of positive feedback. We've had a few messages from people who are interested in helping. We've already got some mentors lined up for the pilot scheme that we're hoping to launch in the summer. So for that, I'd say definitely keep an eye on our Twitter and social media for details for that, because although we have the mentors lined up, we don't have the mentees. The young people that we're hoping to help.
And if there's anyone listening now who feels they could benefit from the offering that you're putting out there, can they get in touch with you now?
So we don't actually have the scheme open for applications yet.
Okay.
I would definitely say follow us on social media.
Yeah.
And then also our website, which is linked from all of our social media, is aviationinreach.org.uk.
Okay, that's brilliant. Thank you. So coming back to you, Kim, what's the sort of advice you'd like to give to somebody considering a career in air traffic control?
Do it. Try it. It is the best career in the world, in my opinion. And I know that there are lots of people who consider it, but only mine is true. I pinch myself every day that I get to go into work. I consider myself so lucky to be working in the industry that I fell in love with as a teenager and, you know, as a young woman. There is no one size fits all when it comes to air traffic. There is nothing really that excludes you from it. You could have aubergine coloured hair, you could have rainbow hair, as I've had in the past, male, female, non-binary, any walk of life. It's not, you know, there is no exclusive way to be an air traffic controller. And obviously you can apply through NATS. There are many other ANSPs, so air navigation service providers within the UK, where you can get courses to be approach controller or an aerodrome controller. I obviously tend to be quite NAT-centric. That's my company. But there are other ways to become an air traffic controller that aren't just NAT. So I would say definitely don't, if you want to be an ATS controller, by all means, but don't get disheartened if you don't make it into that. There are other avenues to do it if you really want to do it. And just keep going, and don't let society tell you that you can't or that you shouldn't or that it's too hard, because the hard work is really worth it. Like I've said, I absolutely love my job. I get to go in and talk to pilots all day, and it's just amazing.
I think if anyone's listening, they'll be swayed by that. So Kim, thanks so much for that, really useful. We'll put links to Aviation in Reach in the show notes, but where can we find you online?
So my outspoken account is That Girl Outco on Twitter.
It's a fun follow. Love the dogs.
My dogs are the best part of that account, for sure. It's just a shame I'm not allowed to. I work in a room with no windows, so I can't show planes, and we're not allowed to take photos at work. So I try and talk about air traffic when and where I can. But I just have to be mindful, obviously, that there are certain things I can't share. So it's not a purely air traffic account. If you want to see me take on a few people, definitely follow along.
Come along for the ride. It's really great. And one final question then before you go, Kim. Do you actually have a favourite aeroplane?
I do. It's the A380.
Wow, I wasn't expecting that.
No.
Okay, so tell us why the A380.
So part of my career history, I was airfield operations at Heathrow. So I was an airfield marshaller. And on my very first day being shown around the airfield, we turned the corner of a taxiway and there was an A380 just sat in front of us. And it was just, it looked incredible. And it just looked really, it was just the epitome of big aviation to me. I fell in love with it on site. I had a little love affair with it while I was on the airfield, and I'd always try and marshal one if I could. And I had a little list of the ones that I'd parked from various airlines based on their registrations, which is the most spotter-like I've ever been. I've never been that spotter-like before.
Geek. We've got you there. And we didn't talk about this earlier on when you talked about your career. That's an area that, again, historically has been dominated by men. How did it feel to be a woman in that role?
I was definitely out of place. Tried to make me feel like I was out of place back in that kind of era.
Yeah.
Most of my career has always been in male-dominated industries, for better or for worse. I think it's made me the kind of person that I am. It's kind of maybe the kind of person that challenges that mentality. I loved working airside. There is nothing more, just the smell of aircraft fuel in the morning. You go out in the airfield, you just can't beat it.
And
the
air side, it's the greatest thing.
It's amazing. It was a great career, but it was ultimately always with the aim of getting into air traffic.
And is that a route still open to individuals who maybe don't come through the academic route?
Yes, so I don't know if it's changed now, but to become airfield operations when I was there, you had to already be employed by BAA, as it was then. I think it's HAL now, so Heathrow Airport Limited. So you would tend to go in as a security officer or something within the terminals, and then you would apply internally to become an airfield operations officer.
Interesting.
But it's definitely a way. Being around the airport, I think, is always a good idea. If you can then be listening to the radio, listening to air traffic, it's just another inroad. Controllers are human, so if you see them in the terminal, definitely say hello. We are not. I am definitely human. I am definitely love a chat and a coffee. And would happily talk about my job to anyone who listen. So there are definitely lots of different ways that you can get into air traffic, not just the classic out of school.
No, that's useful. Thanks so much for that, Kim, and thanks for your open and honest discussion. Really enjoyed it. It's great to put a I was going to say a name to a voice because you're in our ears sometimes as a controller. So it's been really good to have a discussion with you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
So that's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts and as well as the wider extended family of supporters, including Mick Oakey at The Aviation Historian. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and you can find Tim, Gareth and Ellie on the extended Twitter, Facebook and Instagram feeds. And with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Kim.
Bye-bye.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons licence.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.